beginning the study on Alzheimer's. Are any of you acquainted with Alzheimer's, besides professionally? Yes?
Well, I was just telling the ladies, I work in a daycare center where we have respite care for Alzheimer's and other people, but mostly Alzheimer's. And it's really a tragic disease. I just feel really bad for those people.
What's the age of anybody with Alzheimer's?
Oh, well, are you talking about the way they react?
No, I'm talking about the chronological.
Oh, well, it could be anywhere from 45 to 85.
And be younger than that.
I guess.
I didn't realize it.
I don't know. I've never seen anybody younger than 35, I guess. 40, that's very rare, but it can be, let's say 35,
How long does it take to actually get a diagnosis of Alzheimer's?
Anybody want to make a guess? You've got to, before you can make the diagnosis, somebody has to be worried about it and say, you've got to go to the doctor because. And so people can usually think back and say, yeah, you know, Uncle Joe was funny, you know, at Thanksgiving time when the whole family got together, you can never pin him down to anything. He was always turning the question back to you and so on. Because we get very, very good at hiding our deficits as long as we can recognize the deficits. So I would presume that most people can look back at least a year, maybe even 2 years. Of course, then we say, well, I've been forgetting names for all my life. Maybe that's when I started my Alzheimer's, I don't know. Another interesting thing, how many of you, or how long ago did you first hear the term Alzheimer's?
Not very long ago, a couple of years.
Is it just a new disease?
No.
It's not a new disease. I think they finally recognize there is a disease.
What did we call it in the past? And?
Dementia.
It is a dementia. Oh, he's just got hardening of the arteries.
Oh, yeah.
You can read arteries there, can't you? Just what, about 20 years ago, 18 years ago when I went into psychiatry, we very seldom gave anybody a diagnosis of Alzheimer's after the age of 65. In the first place, it was thought that Alzheimer's was only the disease of the brain deterioration before the age of 65. Afterwards, you were senile. Well, 65, anytime you have a cutoff like that, you should become very suspicious that that's artificial. But we tend to call people, say it while they had hardening of the arteries, because at that time it seemed as though people were very much more accepting of the diagnosis of hardening of the arteries. Everybody has hardening of the arteries and therefore it was all right. But then the pathologist started to say, hey, at least 50% of these people that you're calling hardening of their arteries really have Alzheimer's. And now I think that, well, there are two diseases which we're supposed to talk about today. One is Alzheimer and the other is multiple small strokes, but that's the lay term, and I was trying to think of the professional term. But anyway, that's what it is, small strokes, multiple small cavities throughout the brain, usually without having any muscle at that, so it doesn't hit that part of the brain as much. Usually you have a larger one that does that. You don't usually have just one finger or one set of fingers affected. When you have a stroke, you know, there's a greater part. But the multiple small strokes can give you a syndrome, because it's continuing, much like Alzheimer's. It comes in, you have something like that. You get over the stroke a little bit, and it goes down again. Well, Alzheimer's is that way. And that's about the only way that you can distinguish the two of them before you do an autopsy. Or you can do a biopsy. Very seldom done, but if there's a question of whether or not this happened, this is a dementia, which merely means the brain isn't working, organically isn't working, dementia due to an infectious agent or tumor, whatever, something that could be cured, then you drill a hole in the skull and take out with what they call a biopsy needle and take out a small a plug, look at it under the microscope and see if you can find the characteristic degeneration that you would see in the brain due to Alzheimer's. This is seldom done because most of the time you don't worry about these other things. You should, but most of the time it's quite clear. But if it isn't, they may even do a biopsy and prove it. I think one of the important things in... Did you have the eraser sometime? One of the important things in understanding the disease is to understand how the brain works. Of course, I'm not sure that anybody understands how the brain works, but at least we understand the units. You have a neuron, which has a cell body, and a long or shorter, depending on where it is, process coming out here, which ends in sort of a plaque with a space in between. Now this is submicroscopic space. But about 100 years ago, a Spanish neurologist by the name of Cahill, I'm sure that isn't the way the Spanish would have pronounced it, but said, hey, these things cannot be directly connected together. There must be a space in between them so that the message can go only one way, can't come back. So, actually there is, and there is sort of a sponge or a blotter in between, and it's, what, a micron or... It's a very small distance, so that chemicals which are put out there can cross over to here very rapidly. But they don't come backwards, fortunately. It only goes one way. And when you say only, you get into trouble, of course. There are times when you can't go backwards. Haven't heard that? This is the first time in the week and a half that we've been here. Last year they had a lot of them. Okay, what happens when you do this, and usually I should have made another neuron here, but usually it's on a neuron or on a process from the neuron. Supposing you're thinking, or you feel, sense something. Okay, what happens is that a chemical, electrochemical message comes down that neuron, hey, I'm in chemistry, am I not? And when it gets down to the end here, these things are given off. They're taken up. How? We're not quite sure. There's an old theory that it's a key and lock situation from the chemicals that are put out here. They put out the right key to fit into the lock here, and it probably is that. But what happens is that when a message goes in there, it changes the bias, I'm into sewing now, the bias of the nerve. Supposing it's a, and these are just, they're hard to remember for me. Maybe I'm getting Alzheimer's. But the voltage is within, there's an electrical charge within this neuron. Say it's 60 millivolts, 1,000th of a volt, negative. Okay, as you get, this message comes in here, and it drives it down to, say, 59 millivolts. It changes the voltage, lowers the voltage. And if you can lower it, depends on how many messages come in and from where, because there are up to 10,000 connections from one nerve to another. That's why it gets so complicated. It's really very difficult to figure out all the circuits in the brain. Neuroanatomy was enough to drive me right into dementia. But supposing you had enough to drive it down to, say, 40. You had enough different nerves coming into there. At that point, this one will fire. And you see, by having all these different neurons come in, you can modulate. So it isn't just jerky. What you're doing is raising and lowering the bias of the neuron until it hits this spot, and at that spot it fires. And that's all that a nerve can do. That is, the neuron can do. Fire or not fire? It's yes or no. True and false test. Very much like a computer. That's exactly how the computer is built, with elements which say yes or no. What happens, supposedly, as far as we can tell, what happens in Alzheimer's is that the nerve gets sick. This neuron gets sick. In certain areas, particularly first, it's hit not sure I can remember the locus coeruleus. Is that a nice name? Which has to do with memory, particularly, appears to be affected first, and that's one of the reasons that you have difficulty remembering names, dates, and so forth. This is sick and actually probably destroyed. And how you determine that the person has it, the pathologist determines it, is that when those are destroyed, they tend to clump together and you get plaques and neurofibrillary tangles, like my tongue. There's one more thing which has escaped me at the moment. These kind of things you look at and you see that there actually is destruction within the brain. That's the main thing to remember. That it's destruction. The favorite destroying agent at the present time is a slow virus. But there are all kinds of reasons that have been given, none of them proven. Not even this slow virus has been proven for the disease. But we do know that this happens, that the cells are destroyed. It doesn't sweep right through and destroy everything in its way. It acts very slowly, destroys one here and one there. More in certain areas to begin with. In fact, your muscles aren't affected for a long time than the parts that the parts of the brain that drives your breathing, for instance. Now, questions at this point, the physiology of it.
Yeah. Does that happen that you get to the point where you can't breathe because of Alzheimer's?
Most people die of an infection first of some kind.
It could happen, it's conceivable.
We didn't see that much because it also seems to destroy something about the immune system, so that you tend to get more diseases. Remember when bronchopneumonia was the old man's friend? And that was part of it. So, but yes, they go downhill and to the point in which they're bedridden. We did see that.
Did you say why are these destroyed? What are some of the causes? Are you going to go into that? Or did I miss it? Slow virus
is one.
And we're not aware of that, probably.
And we're not aware of it? No. Is it an old measles virus that stays around with you for the rest of your life? Or is it something entirely new and different? You don't know. You don't seem to catch it from somebody. So, you know, it doesn't look like it's...
Is there a hereditary...
Mm-hmm. Well, that's been argued. There, in certain types, I guess, and I couldn't even tell you the types, there is a very minimal pressure towards heredity, but not a great deal. It isn't something you got to say, hey, Aunt so-and-so had it, I'm going to get it.
Just the week. Go ahead.
Is it dietary,
the
lack of something?
There have been a lot of things accused, among them aluminum. Mm-hmm. There is no evidence that there was more, that there is more of this in cultures that use a lot of aluminum. At one point, I don't know, some of you may remember what aluminum dishes and cooking were. It was considered to be terrible because of that. By some people, but we haven't been able to show. There is more aluminum in these plaques than ordinary, but that's probably only a fortuitous finding, not from what you have. They worked real hard on proving that or disproving it. There isn't any evidence to support it.
What about an unbalanced diet?
Any more than, well, it's pretty hard to unbalance a diet to that extent. We did in the past in the South, for instance, the poor who were living only on sow belly and what was it?
Grits.
Where you really didn't have, you know, in those kind of diets you could go get a true avitaminosis without a doubt. Somebody on ships. Getting scurvy and so on, but you don't get this seemingly from that. It probably doesn't make sense that they would.
What about other cultures, Chinese or East Indian?
As far as I've seen, have you read anything about cross culture? I haven't read that there is any difference, and it certainly is one thing that they would look at. One of the difficulties you have, of course, is to know that you get the same type, that you're looking at the same group of people when you're saying how many are demented and how many are not. there are other things you can be recommended for, certainly, including alcohol, or some medications. The most satisfying thing I think I had as a psychiatrist was having this gentleman come in, several of them in fact, that happened. He was certainly demented. He was seeing things, visions, you know, the whole thing. And that's one thing. If a person has visual hallucinations, then you can start to think about something organic. But then Alzheimer's is organic. It's part of the brain. And you ask and say, does the man have Parkinson's? Yes, he has Parkinson's, and he is taking L-DOPA. Well, a certain number of people with a certain level of L-DOPA are going to be demented. That's what happens with the medication. And so all I had to do was say, no, he won't take L-DOPA here. The poor neurologist had to work around that when I sent him back to him. But it was, you know, magic. 2-3 days, he was over it, just because we stopped his medication. That isn't saying it was a bad medication, but the level that he was getting it for him, it was a bad medication.
What about beta blockers? That sounds like you're blocking something in the brain.
Well, yes, you are. Down here, all this stuff is done, all blocking is done down there, but not so much in the brain. Most of that is done, you're interested in the peripheral area. And those do help for reducing, you block this so this can't be as effective. You know, if this gets too hair trigger, you do too. And you're using beta blockers to try and reduce your blood pressure, for instance. So you're blocking, and peripherally, you're blocking it here so that the nerve impulses don't come down and say, hey, get that pressure up.
Is this the same picture then for strokes too? I mean, would that be the same type of a thing that happens?
In some ways it is, because in a stroke you have don't you like my artist juice? You have a big chunk coming down here. It can go through here all right, but it comes down here and it can't go any further. That's an embolism. Supposing you have, and one of the more common reasons for strokes are the plugged carotids, which have rotting material in them, they break off and then they hit. That's particularly with the multiple small strokes. And hit this, and then it's plugged up. You don't have good circulation around it in the brain, depending on how that's plugged up. And that part dies. So these cells die. They usually die up in the motor areas, and so that you can tell that it's effective because you can't move your hand or your foot. But that's an entirely different cause, but coming to the same result, because these things have to have blood. You die. So I got the second part of the talk over with.
The week before I came up, somebody had discovered one of the viruses or bacteria that caused the common cold. And they said there was a lot of hope for working with Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, and a couple of other diseases from discovering that bacteria or virus.
If, you know, I don't know all the ramifications of that discovery. We can certainly hope for it. Let's hope that it does. I've seen so many, every year they come out with some cure for Alzheimer's. You know, you take this medication, you take that medication. And this was one of the troubles with calling this the hardening of the arteries. Because if it's hardening of the arteries, you weren't getting enough blood to the brain, therefore you would take some kind of medication to expand the vessels so that you'd get more blood to the brain. And it sounded logical. Of course, one of the problems was that it also expanded the blood to the muscles and the rest of your body, and so it stole from the brain. So you ended up worse than you were before. But actually, you weren't hitting the problem, which is the death of these cells. It's progressive. About how many people, supposing that we reach 80, all of us here, and there are what? 20 here. How many of us at 80 would, just statistically, if you were in Sweden, because that's one of the few countries that has good enough statistics, you never leave the county you were born with. All your vital statistics go back to them, so they keep a good track of you. If you were in Sweden, if we were in Sweden, how many of us would have Alzheimer's at 80? Of course, those of us who have reached 80 and don't have it, it's unfair because that would skew it the other way. But what would you guess?
5%.
Five of us?
5%.
5%. That's different from Shakespeare's view, doesn't he? You remember that? All the world's a stage, and you know, starting out as a babe mewling and puking in its mother's arms. I love that. But at the end, why, you know, you can hardly get along and you're slobbering and what have you. Okay, you people are far too optimistic. Actually, it would be about 20%, about four of us, if we were in Sweden. Now, I can't say what it would be here, but that's about what they found. And most people that you'd ask, you're such a wonderful group here, because you don't have to give the right answers at all. You don't have coronary heart disease, you don't have, you do have deafness, but you are willing to wear your amplifiers. That's the fancy new word I learned. So it may not be at all with our group. We don't know how it varies with the groups that you're talking about. But in general, it's only one out of five that would get hit.
I'm curious how positive is their diagnosis?
Again, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know at what point they made the diagnosis. Evidently, they checked with the hospital diagnoses, I suppose, and said, hey, so many people have been given the diagnosis of Alzheimer's at 80, and there are these many people that, as far as I know, they didn't give the exact figures on it, but these are pretty popular figures. What can you do for them? Or what can you do for me when I get it? First of all, how would you tell that I had it? I'm not sure I should go in.
Memory loss.
Confusion.
The first thing is memory loss. How do you check on that? How would you know?
me, I can remember my mother saying, you'd forget your head if it wasn't tied on. And you mentioned that too. I have never been able to remember numbers or names. How can you tell when it's...
How much memory loss is acceptable?
I think you'd have to almost have somebody who knew the person, and names or numbers or something like that may not be the thing you're looking at. Like faces or where you've been or some short-term memory versus long-term memory.
Short-term memory is better or longer than the, well, it depends on how short, you know, the repeating of a name after you look. 5 minutes afterwards is the important place to look for.
I know an elderly couple who and he had told us about a year ago that he has Alzheimer's, cannot remember anything, but they took a long trip to Norway just this summer, and my sister was visiting with them, and talking about the trip, and it had been a very enjoyable trip for them, but he could not remember one incident or one place that they had been. The entire recounting of the trip had to be what the wife remembered, because he was unable to contribute anything, and this was a matter of a month or so after they returned.
Even though he had enjoyed it a great deal, which is, I think, is something we should remember, is that a person can enjoy what's going on at the time, even though he can't remember to 10 minutes later. Like so many of our, well, one of our patients particularly, I remember, who said, have we eaten breakfast yet? You know, half an hour after he'd come up.
Going to church on a Wednesday and thinking it's Sunday.
That's a common.
It's another concern for older people being by themselves who are, for instance, taking medications. They can't remember when they last took a medication, and frequently they over-medicate themselves.
And I'm glad that is not a concrete positive evidence of Alzheimer's.
No, that's right.
And what I find I have to do, take nitro 3 times a day. If I can put it in a box, I don't even have to have a division there, but had a little aspirin box, which I've lost now, so I'm really in trouble. And then I put it in the morning, and if there's still one there, or if there's still two there, well, I haven't taken it. I haven't really done it. So we need memory aids. That's one of the things that all of us need to use at all times, really. But particularly for an Alzheimer's, in the first year or two, he probably will find for himself, you're being sexist, you women are just as much. And one thing, anyhow, you are just as liable as we are, is to make use of memory aids.
Speaking of diagnoses, we have a neighbor who, she had gone to the doctor because she was having trouble with confusion and so on, and she says, you know, he gave me a diagnosis, I can't remember what the name of it was. Mm-hmm. And so somebody said, Alzheimer's? Yeah, that was it. Which is about, you know, the way that it would affect it. It's interesting that some people have found, at least, that the time that you forget, I mean, that to complain about forgetting is in your 40s. That we, more mature here, don't complain about the forgetting as much as we did back when we were 40. Either we've gotten used to it, maybe we're more embarrassed about it now, I don't know. But the complaining about, the worrying about the forgetfulness is more at 40 than it is at 60, 70.
The progression of the disease can be, you know, from the 40s on up to 80, is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah.
That you start losing these neurons.
You start losing the neurons the day you're born. Or probably the day before you're born.
But do you replace them?
No.
You never replace them.
And you can see how you'd be in trouble if you did.
you know, you'd have stuff that, you'd have to have some way to work them in, or otherwise you'd end up with a new brain, which wouldn't be too good either, because you wouldn't have learned all the things that go with it. You'd get things connected up wrong, probably. Anyhow, that's my theory. That isn't...
Well, are you saying that all of us who have memory loss are going to end up with... I don't think you are, but I'm just questioning
you
to straighten it out.
There are two things that are happening. One is that all of us lose brain cells, these things we were talking about, these neurons. For all of us, they were up. And the brain shrinks as we age. As we become ripe, the brain shrinks, which is one of the problems, because there are vessels from your skull into your brain. When the connection, there's always a liquid in there, but when we're young, there isn't that much space for the brain to wobble around in. As we get older and have more loss, it's shrunk, and the wobbling of the brain can tear those vessels, and then you get bleeding in the brain. That's why it's so much more dangerous for us to be in a car accident, to fall down, hit our head on something, because our brain wobbles around. In fact,
if you get that bleeding, does that then become a small stroke?
The small stroke comes from cutting off the blood supply to a particular area. What happens in the bleeding within the membranes of the brain is that it squeezes the whole brain over, and you need to drain it. Oh, wisdom. Here is something, I think most of us, this is one of the things that keeps worrying us, you know. Are we getting dumber? We hear, oh, I couldn't go back to school now because the young can do all this learning so much better than the old. That probably isn't true. It may be true that our brain power, as far as number of cells is concerned, is going down. On the other hand, this is that crystallized wisdom? I forget the technical term for it. Our wisdom is going, in other words, how we learn. We've all learned tricks in learning. We know so much that we can take out of our past experience to help us in learning. So that when you add these two up, even your IQ scores, when they've done longitudinal scoring, where they've taken a person and now they've been able to do it from the time he's 30 or from the time he's 80. And until you start with Alzheimer's or some such thing, or the multiple dementias, this stays up, the IQ. Now, in the past, we didn't think so, when they were taking a cross-section. And then they came to the conclusion that this is probably due to the type of instrument we use, the test. The test was better for testing young people than older ones. That was testing the experience of the young people, so on, rather than the experience of old people. And so it really wasn't honest in what they found. So our IQ stands up, and if you've been in classes with young people who have gone to school with them, or you find that your drive, your patience, your past experience more than makes up for this obvious loss of brain cells that we have. Fortunately, we have a lot more than we need. We're always hearing you aren't using your brain to its full potential and so on. Which is a very comforting thing to me, that your actual power of thinking probably remains very much the same. You know, we may get in a rut all that kind of thing. But not counting that, our brain power remains the same. What are you going to do for an Alzheimer's? You can't replace the cells that are dead. We don't know how to stop it yet. So what? What should we do about it?
Can you slow it down?
We can't slow it down yet, as far as I know. We're hoping there are, well, every 2-3 years there's something that comes out with a lot of hope. I have become pessimistic, but I shouldn't. But someday we're going to hit something that's going to stop it. Yes?
The university's been having a lot of research on Alzheimer's, and they have been trying different drugs with people in nursing homes in the Seattle area. And one woman we know seems to have been helped a little bit by whatever it is that they gave her, you know, because she at least wants to have her hair fixed and is a little bit more concerned about her person than she was. A little bit more able to talk, I think. Maybe her memory's not that much better, but she seems more appropriate in what she does and says. We don't know what that is, though, I guess, do we?
No, it'll probably come out under a different name as well, if it works. Many of these things seem to have an effect, but then when you start looking at everybody, there's that placebo effect, which is wonderful. If you take something for your aches and pains and you ought to be cured, oftentimes you are.
Besides from learning, is there any value in simple orientation therapy? Reminding a person many, many times a day that they are not a little girl any longer, that they are in the home, etc., etc. They're happy to be a little girl and to live in this fantasy world, and I'm wondering if there's any value in bringing them back.
Certainly no long-term value. That, yeah, and you'll run into this, I'm sure, especially if they're in the hospital, but also in some nursing home, because it's one of the only things we know how to do. It's good for the time that you do it, but as soon as you stop, it fades away. So, and you bring up a good point. Are they happier in their dementia and their delusions than they are, than they would be with reality? And it's one thing you have to always debate with yourself whenever you're having anyone who's hallucinating, delusional, or
leads into another question. There used to be an old saw that the people in the asylum were happier than the folks outside, because if a guy thought he was Napoleon, nobody in the asylum contradicted him, and he was a happy Napoleon for the rest of his life. Like that movie where the saw last Saturday evening, the folks in the asylum, as long as they were there, they were happy. Nobody contradicted.
There's only one problem with that. Nobody comes and bows to you.
Well, they don't need actual people who bow. They have these imaginary folks.
Well, the problem is that you have negative feedback. You see, if you'd only feed into it, really feed into it, well, you know, that really is a matter of something you should factor into your treatment. One of the things that we have felt as therapists is that even though a person, you know, grandma doesn't remember 5 minutes after you've been there, she says, why doesn't Ole ever come back and see me? Still, during the time, and even if she doesn't recognize Ole when he comes back, yet she feels something about it and feels good. One of the things it does is really impresses the staff. You know, if the relatives are really interested, pleasantly interested, in the sick one, the staff also takes an interest in it. That's the way we humans are. So what I'm trying to say is that, hey, it's good to visit, even though the person seems to get nothing out of it to us.
Does
Does exercise, physical exercise improve the quality at all?
Of life for them?
Yeah, I'm sure it would, wouldn't it?
In fact, this is one of the things that you will find if you're trying to take care of someone, is that there is the, you can call it agitation, or you can call it a hunger for physical.
They're restless.
Restless, very restless. Makes it difficult because they want to get out and walk when they're disoriented, don't know what they're doing, and they're in danger from traffic or the weather. That's one of the problems you have to face if Ole wants to get out. You can't lock him in, really, as part of the family. You legally you can't, but you probably get by with it. But you feel bad about that too. Then if he goes down the road in a light sweater in Iowa, Minnesota, or even here in inclement weather, gets pneumonia. Of course, it isn't a cold given pneumonia, but hypothermia probably added to it. Or he walks in front of the traffic because his judgment is gone at the same time that his memory. See, judgment is pretty contingent on memory, isn't it? You judge this because of what you've had in the past. The oftentimes people do like to get out and walk. They like to. We had a special little room that the porch, in fact, closed porch, where we were able to get stocked it with special furniture, soft but very rugged furniture that they could stack because they just loved to stack. Furniture, I don't know. Isn't it wives that love to move furniture? Right. Well, anyhow, they do too. They just love to move furniture around.
Who is they?
Alzheimer's patients. And wives. And sometimes they'll just love to dust, whether there's dust or not. I mean, this kind of agitation, somebody was asking about that. And that certainly is true. Another thing is that they tend to invert day and night. So they're up at night and want to sleep during the day. And that's why it becomes a 36-hour day. And we knew the title, but we haven't got the author. It's published by Mayo. It does seem like a 36-hour day because they don't sleep at the same time you do. Or they're liable to get up and want to make coffee and they'll turn it on and forget that it's on and boils away, it burns. And you're always afraid that either they will be burned or the house will be burned down, and all this kind of thing. So their safety as well as your safety are two of the major factors when you're thinking about, can we keep them at home? What do you think about keeping an Alzheimer's at home?
Well, I've seen how devastating it can be to the spouse or to the son or daughter whose responsibility it is.
In what way?
Well, it just wears them out physically and emotionally because there's no hope.
And this can last quite a while, can't it? Average was, what, 5 to 7 years, something of that order?
I think people, if a couple is trying to keep an Alzheimer's patient in their home, there's usually only two people there. I mean, the husband and wife, and sometimes not even that many. That's two people. If they were in a nursing home of some sort, they've got a whole staff that rotates shift. They take the responsibility of the 8 hours they're there, but then they go home and they're refreshed themselves. We can't do that in your own very often.
Not all nursing homes can take Alzheimer's patients, depending on what stage they are. When they are no longer mobile, then it's fine. But when they're mobile, they are, by law, you're not allowed to lock somebody up unless you're a judge. you'd have to get, in some states, I guess you'd have to get a permit from court to walk the person up.
So they can't, they accept them into the nursing home?
Do you have any data on the way that a patient reacts in an institution or a home or hospital and at home in their own home?
You mean as far as their...
Their happiness, well-being, progress, or whatever you call it?
Well, both Rosemary and I treated them for a long time. At this age, I wouldn't say it was a long time, about 15 years, but when I was younger, that would have been a long time. And I would judge that, to me it seemed, not having seen them at home, I can't say, but because it had to be one-to-one, because there were all those constraints at home, they seemed to be, to me, happier in the institution than they were at home. Now, it depends on it. If they have to be tied in, even with soft restraints, you're not, you know, there are very definite reasons that are laws about how you can restrain a person. I hate to see a person restrained. I think that really is frustrating to me. I would much rather see the door locked. And that's harder to get by with than soft restraints. I think they are happier.
In the Portland area, there's a couple of nursing homes that I go into, and they have very tall chain link fences around the yard. Mm-hmm. And the doors to the building are open, but the chain link fence is locked.
So that technically they can get out. Mm-hmm. Actually, somebody's probably out the door in some of the places. Two of them. Watching. I mean, there are ways to get around, but they're expensive usually. Another way, the same way you do with they're trying with keeping prisoners at home by putting a radio transmitter on their foot, their leg, and you can, you know, they can't go out beyond the home or else the buzzer goes off and so on. And those kind of things could be done, but they're expensive. But what you're saying is good, and the things I think I would look for, if one of mine, or if I were going to think, now, I would like to be in this institution or that one, if I were Alzheimer's, then one of them would be just what you were saying, a good place to be outside of have a modicum of freedom.
I think most everybody keeps the person at home as long as they can. You know, until they start having behavior that they just can't cope with, like inappropriate sexual behavior or spitting or hitting or being very agitated. That's the time when we would get them into our institution, at least, is when the behavior just became impossible.
We have 4 minutes.
Impossible.
Well, we kept our mother at home as long as we could. This is in North Dakota, and we had a paid attendant, but you know, the paid attendant did have to go to the bathroom occasionally, and that sort of thing. My mother got out in the snowbanks twice, and it was a dangerous situation, and so we just couldn't.
Yes?
Now, this business of locking up was, new to me. I guess I never really stopped to think about it. When my mother gets up, she is locked into the wheelchair all day long. And is that legal? I've never thought about it. They have to restrain her some way, or she endanger her life. But just locking up, that's new to me.
No, I'm not going to give an answer, because I don't know what exactly the law in the state of Washington is at this time.
Well, this is in Oregon.
In Oregon.
Yeah.
But I know that we had those difficulties in all the hospitals that I worked in, or at least in Connecticut and Iowa. Mm-hmm. And it's something to remember.